When we left off in the first session, we were not quite through with Ecclesiastes 12, verse 3. There is still one line left in that verse that we need to attend to, and it reads this way: "Those who look through windows grow dim." You probably now are beginning to pick up the way to understand some of these allegories. First of all, we need to take a look at windows. A rectangular opening of a house, often covered with lattice work, through which one can look out. And there are I don't know much about lattice work. I'm sure some of you may. But there are ways. In fact, I saw one in a hotel room down in Shreveport that had lattice work on it. And these are the little panes that come across here like this, and they sort of overlap at these points so that when you pull a little lever or something that runs down the middle, it closes the window off. But if you want to look out, then you manipulate this lever, and, well, it's going to look the same way. But this is window. This is window. You follow this? I don't know why I even try these things. All right, you got it? You pull the lever and you look through this lattice work is the way I figure it, and you can look out. Well, you need to know that. That's the reason I bothered you with it. Point two. In order to control the inside temperatures, this is in the ancient world, windows were usually few in number and they were small in size. They were big enough, however, to permit robbers to enter if they so chose, and therefore these windows were generally placed, if it was a two-story home, on the upper level. So they have to get a ladder or something to sneak in your window. But that was the case that they normally had in the ancient world. Three, as you've probably guessed, Solomon's windows are his eyes. And the lattice work covering them are the eyelids and the eyelashes. So you can close a window by shutting your eyelids, and that's the lattice work closed. And then you open it up, and then you can see out through the windows. Four, with old age, he attempts to open his eyelids in order for his eyes to look out. But even then, his ability to see has grown dim. And you can open the lattice work and still not be able to see. And so today, we know some of the more common causes which diminish eyesight. First of all, there is macular degeneration. This is an affliction sometimes occurring in old age as a result of the hardening of the blood vessels within the eye. This disorder reduces central vision, characterized by a black spot, but it does not interfere with the peripheral vision. So one of the things that can occur in old age, and let's put a TV screen here, for example. You're trying to watch a ball game, and everything in the middle of the screen is blacked out. But you can see peripherally around the edges. And so I can imagine Joe Henry has aunts who suffer from this. All of her aunts wind up with a black spot in front of their face, if they live long enough, and they are living long enough. And Johanna has this condition potentially because of her gene pool, so her optometrist guy is constantly looking out for signals for this. If memory serves me correctly, I believe this is a condition that Mrs. Bruner suffers from as well, or something very, very similar. So it is when you look straight ahead, and I think Pat Carnegie, where is Evelyn? Does Pat have this? Something very similar. So that when you look straight ahead, all you see is a black blotch, but you can see perfectly out around the edges. And I remember in talking with Pat when I first met her, you could be standing directly in front of her, but she will look off to the side. And she explains to you that she's not ignoring you or being rude, but that's the only way she can see you, to get you away from the black blotch. So to move you into the peripheral area to where she can see you, she has to look off to the side and then watch you from peripheral vision. Now, this is a way in which, even though you open the lattice work, you're not seeing very well. This is macular degeneration. Secondly, there's the possibility that Solomon suffered from cataracts. There are several forms of cataracts. Some are congenital. Some are due to the illness of the mother during pregnancy. Others are the result of disease. For example, those who suffer from diabetes mellitus. Now, the most common is the type that develops with advancing age. Such cataracts are the effect of the continuing growth of the lenses throughout the life, the lenses within the eye. These things continue to grow. And when they do, there is an attendant increase in their density, and therefore it begins to cloud the vision. Interestingly enough, here's something we can all look out for who wear glasses, and this may be happening to me. When you begin to develop cataracts and the lenses grow, there's a certain point as they change their shape and their density that you no longer need to wear glasses. But that only happens briefly, and then as it continues to grow and get beyond that point, then it begins to degenerate quite quickly. Modern medicine today is able to blast these things off, and you can return to fairly decent eyesight, but you in some cases have to wait until it's gone through the process and then have them removed. In the ancient world, Solomon did not have that advantage, so he probably suffered from both. So Ecclesiastes 12, verse 3 again in the New American Standard. In the day when the watchmen of the house tremble, the mighty men stoop, and the grinding ones stand idle because they are few, and those who look through windows grow dim. Our corrected and expanded translation to bring into view what the allegories are about. In the day when the arms and hands tremble from Parkinson's disease, the legs are feeble and bowed, the teeth are useless because they are so few in number, and the eyes grow dim due to macular degeneration and cataracts. The fourth verse, Ecclesiastes 12:4, and the doors on the street are shut as the sound of the grinding mill is low, and one will arise at the sound of a bird, and all the daughters of song will sing softly. Point one. Solomon continues with the afflictions associated with aging as he describes further handicaps to normal daily living. The doors on the street are shut is the first line we note. The general way by which a person makes contact with the outside world is by walking outside through the door of his house. You know, few people who crawl through windows unless they have lost their key. So the normal way is to go through the door. Secondly, a person who rarely does this is called a recluse, a hermit, an eremite, or a troglodyte. These are people who just love to be alone and they stay inside and rarely go out. There's not much communication from these people. Three, the way a person individually reaches out to the outside world then is through conversation. That's how you make contact. Even those who are unable to speak learn ways to communicate. Surrogate mouths and larynxes, so to speak. I have a new step niece who cannot speak. But she's learned a number of ways to communicate, and some of them actually get to the point of being able to sign, as it's called. Well, they wouldn't be doing that if they could speak. That's how you communicate with the outside world. And so he who opens his mouth is able to communicate. Four, in Solomon's example, the lips of the mouth are referred to as the doors that are now shut. The lips of the mouth are the doors that are now shut. That's how you open up your soul and go outside self and communicate with others. Five, the idea is that with few teeth, the lips are drawn inward into the mouth, the opposite of their normal condition. Now, one of the things that enables you to look normal, let's call it, normal meaning that the lips protrude outwardly rather than inwardly, is that the teeth are there. And when the teeth go away, there's a cavity, and the mouth begins to recede in begin to recede into the mouth. And if you've ever seen one without their dentures in or with no teeth at all, that is their appearance, and it is a symbol, a sign, an indication of old age. Ecclesiastes 12:4b, as the sound of the grinding mill is low. Point one. Again, Solomon refers to his teeth. We have learned that they are so few in number that they're useless to him in masticating his food. Your mother may have told you, as mine did me, that digestion begins in the mouth. Therefore, chew your food. Quit eating your food whole, or things of that nature. So you're supposed to sit there and very boringly chew this stuff up rather than getting done with it and move on with what you had to do. So you have to chew up your food in order to maintain good health. Chew your food. Well, I'm not giving you instructions here. I mean, you're well old enough to know how to chew your food. But that's the point we have here. Point two. So as a result, Solomon must crush his food with his gums. And this is a pitiful sight to see if you've ever seen anyone without dentures but have lost their teeth and they try to eat. It's a struggle for them. But they have to eat in order to stay alive. So they sort of gnaw on whatever they put in their mouth, and as a result, they normally eat things that don't have to be chewed up very much. So it's soft food. Have a soft diet like oatmeal. Now this gives off a low masticating sound, munching, kind of sucking and champing noise as you move the food around trying to find a hard place on your gum to give it a blow. Solomon is trying to make this sound pitiful. I mean, we've got a guy here, everything that can go wrong with regard to aging has gone wrong, and he has nothing in his soul to balance any of this out. So the normal sound of chewing his food with his teeth is little heard. Now, have you ever heard somebody who really could make a racket when they chewed? That I've finally figured out why they play music in restaurants. So you don't hear all of this. You know, I once heard it was rude to play music when you invited people over, that you're saying, well, you know, you can't entertain me, I have to play music. But I'm thinking, no, we need to get away from that. We need to turn the music on and put it up loud so that nobody can hear all this sucking and munching and chomping and spewing and whatever. That's what it's for. So four, good digestion, as our mothers told us, begins in the mouth. You must chew your food before you swallow it. Now, you can just swallow it whole, but you will get the colic when you do that. Now, when you don't have teeth, the food is not masticated properly and poor digestion results. And so the sound of the grinding mill also includes the growling of the stomach during digestion, or attempted digestion as the case might be. Ecclesiastes 12:4c. One will arise at the sound of a bird. Point one. Often the many varied discomforts of the aging process cause a person to lose sleep. My dad wakes up at like 5 or 6 in the morning and he's done with the sleeping process. He is up. I barely get to sleep by 6 o'clock. Some of the things that keep you awake, for example, reflux. Reflux is a nice way of saying you puke while you sleep. This is because of indigestion, and there's this constant battle to keep the food that you've recently fought to get down, and keep it there. And then there's constantly having to get up to make little short trips from prostatitis. Prostatitis, what that actually means is that you think you've gone to the restroom, but you haven't finished. You think you've finished, but you haven't. You will be back. You'll be back soon. There's arthritis. There's no way to find a place in the bed that is comfortable. Every place you find, every position you take, another joint hurts. So when you get it comfortable, another one's hurting. So then it's up to go get the Advil. The other aches and pains contribute, all of these things together contribute to a thing called insomnia, and therefore poor rest and ultimately poor health. Point two. Another worry is that which is associated with a reversionistic environment in the soul. The longer you stay awake, the more you have time to think about poor decisions limiting future options, what a low life you've been, how you could have done better but didn't, and all of these things mill around in the mind as you lay in bed unable to sleep, thus contributing to the insomnia in itself. 3. A man who has become physically weakened by age still has the same concerns for physical safety that he had while in good health. And so while you lay in your bed and under a guilt complex, unable to sleep because of all the pain and the reflux and the trips to the bathroom, and you lay there and you begin to think, well, I deserve to suffer for all that I've done wrong, and you visualize that every sound is an intruder coming in to brain you and take your stuff. So a man who has become physically weakened by age still has the same concerns for physical safety that he had when in good health. 4. Now that he can no longer defend his home and hearth, he becomes frightened at the slightest noise, even that of a chirping bird. If you don't hear very well, a chirping bird in the wee hours of the night may sound like a creaking board. The boogers are in the house. 5. Near blindness, weak legs, and trembling arms cause him to become easily frightened, and thus there is no rest for the weary soul. Fear, you will note, underlies a lot of this. Ecclesiastes 12, 4d, and all the daughters of song will sing softly. First of all, daughters of song is an idiom for the ears. In Solomon's case, the ears are singing softly. He is still able to hear, but everything sounds as if the volume is turned down. I went through that for 5 years. The volume on the right side was turned down to maybe 30%. And I assumed I was deaf. And then started going to Shreveport, for example, and got up around 30,000 feet, an explosion would go off, and I could hear perfectly. And then about an hour later, they would land, and it would all be over. So I figured if I could just live at 30,000 feet, I would do fine. And so Weldon told me, if you can hear at all, then there's something else different here. You're not deaf. You can hear, then there's something that needs to be looked into. And I don't really need to go into what occurred next, but I went to the doctor, and I'm able to hear perfectly now. But I do have orientation for the volume being turned down. In fact, when I left that doctor's office and could hear perfectly, when I got into my car, now I'm hearing things that happened to the right side. I hadn't heard in 5 years. And when I get in my car, you know how a seat will sort of squeak and the leather sort of crunches a little bit when you get in? And I heard that for the first time, and I wheeled around to see who it was in the car with me. And then, it's me. Well, that's the sound being turned low. So loss of hearing can be very frustrating, and if you love to hear music played and songs sung, and Solomon did, he hired choirs and bands and orchestras and come into his palace and entertain him. He loved to have this go on. And then he got to where he couldn't hear it. Of course, he didn't have a stereo where you could run it up to about 9. So they could sing just as loud as they could sing, and that was it. And he was very frustrated. He loved to hear music played and songs sung, but his approaching deafness was very frustrating. Ecclesiastes 12:4, New American Standard. And the doors on the street are shut as the sound of the grinding mill is low, and one will arise at the sound of a bird, and all the daughters of song will sing softly. Corrected translation, expanded a bit. The lips are drawn into the mouth, and the sound of one's chewing and digestion is a low grinding. From anxiety attacks, even the singing of a bird will cause him to awaken, and his ears are unable to hear clearly the voices of singing. Ecclesiastes 12:5, New American Standard. Furthermore, men are afraid of a high place and of terrors on the road. The almond tree blossoms, the grasshopper drags himself along, and the caperberry is ineffective. I don't think we need much explanation on this one. We'll just go on to verse 6. I think not. And he finishes up, by the way, saying, "For man goes to his eternal home while mourners go about in the street." He's about dead now, please note, in verse 5. Point 1. This verse adds the element of fear from the environment, areas of life not formerly a concern. Some of you are not afraid at all to drive home when we leave here today. There are going to be times in your life when you will become afraid. And we're going to take that up in this verse. Secondly, in addition, three things associated with aging are mentioned as additional afflictions. So we're going to note fear of the environment. Three additional things noted associated with aging as additional afflictions. And finally, we see the old man enter the death-shadowed valley. First of all, Ecclesiastes 12:5a, men are afraid of high places and of terrors on the road. Point 1. With a degenerating body, the old man is averse to going outside the house. And when he does, he becomes afraid of the normal conditions of his environment. Do you have any problem, for example, standing on a chair, getting up on a step ladder, balancing yourself on the edge of a rocker to change the light in the ceiling? There will come a day to where normal things that you were used to doing when the legs were okay, the sense of balance was there, you didn't think about not doing that. But now you do, you're afraid of that idea. For example, 2, he's afraid of a high place. It doesn't have to be a very high place. It can be a chair. It can be stepping off a curb. Now they just chop the curb off and make this little slanted place. That's because people are afraid of high places and they have to roll their wheelchairs in and out. That's one thing, but other people are afraid of high places. They don't like stepping off a curb. They want to just go down the ramp. So, he is afraid of a high place. Now, some people retire so they can go to the mountains. Solomon wouldn't do that. Some have a desire to go to the top of the Gateway Arch and look about. Solomon would not want to do that. Others envision standing on the rim of the Grand Canyon and looking down. Not Solomon. 3, even walking about is a chore for a man in his condition. For example, on unpaved roads, you remember in our studies of wheel tracks that roads in the ancient world were sometimes not much more than wheel tracks, and thus they were riddled with obstacles. You know, when a king came into town, one of the big deals that the people of the city would become involved in was a cleanup of the road. They would go out and haul all of the rocks and boulders out of the way and make it easy for the king to ride into town. And so it was not common to walk down a road that didn't have all of these things littered in your way. Now, an old man who can't see, can't hear, is weak, suffering from Parkinson's disease, his knees are blown out, he doesn't like to go out and walk down the road. He can't see the obstacles. He will stumble over them, fall, and break something else. So these are the things he's afraid of. So even walking about is a chore. 4. In his youth, he could walk through mud, go up hills, step around rocks, challenge inclines. None of these things would be a problem for him. And they're probably not a problem for you, because none of you are really in old age. You can go and walk down the road, even littered with items, and not be afraid of them. And some of you can even walk up a hill without having a coronary. This man actually has that on his mind, that his heart's going to fail him. So 5, an undulating path is now too steep and too hilly as far as he's concerned. Oh, that's too hard. I can't do that. The sun's too hot in the summertime. Or the winter's too cold. I can relate to that. It rains. When it rains, then it's too bad to go out. I don't want to go out in the rain. People, by the way, are afraid of catching a cold by going out into the rain. And I've recently read that that has nothing to do with it. Getting wet in a windstorm will not give you a bad cold. But it will mess up your clothes. 6. These normal daily occurrences now present a sort of fear. They are a source of fear for him, especially when you add the worry of highwaymen along the way. And they had that worry in that day. And that's why you remember they took a staff with them. That was the Makara became the Colt 45 of the ancient world when they got rid of those long staffs. But the staff could be used as a defensive weapon, as we've learned. And why? Because of the threat of highwaymen. Now, how is an old man suffering from the things we've seen, even with a staff, going to be able to defend himself? Very, very difficult if he can't see his attacker. So when you are afraid of the normal conditions of your environment, then you have become afraid of life. If your environment is a thing that causes you fear, then you've become afraid of life. You can't get away from your environment. Ecclesiastes 12:5b, the almond tree blossoms. Point one, the almond tree blossoms toward the end of January, and it does so before its leaves appear. The almond tree is quite unusual in that it does this, and it blossoms in the middle of winter, actually toward the end of it. And these blossoms come out, there's not a leaf on the tree, just a bunch of flowers. Two, these blossoms are white, tinged with pink, but from a distance the appearance is striking. You see all of these limbs filled with white blossoms, but there's not a leaf on it. So it appears as if it's snow-covered, so to speak. Three, then in late winter, these blossoms turn to pure white, and then the winds of late winter blow these pure white blossoms off the tree, and they fall and are blown all around it. Four, the allegory refers to the white hair of an old man in his final winter, as his hair begins to fall out as the falling blossoms, he will not know another spring. White hair is now falling out, and it's in the winter, and he will not know another spring. Ecclesiastes 12:5c, the grasshopper drags himself along. I even have a visual. Mr. Grasshopper, point one. I've got four little short points here, but this took half a day. And the thing about this study is I'm taking hours and hours and hours to try and get this right. And then I've taught you almost five verses today. I had the St. Louis Bible Conference, and then I had this passage here, which was taking a tremendous amount of research and teach it in 10 minutes. And then I had to get ready for the Shreveport Bible Conference. I then decided to do an Easter special, and we just threw in a funeral to boot. And so with all of that going on, and I come back to St. Louis, and last night I sit down at my computer to start again, and I'm all hung up in verse 6. I've got a deal going on in verse 6, and I have read and read and read. It has to do with the well and the wheel and the cistern and all this business. And I've got all this information, but you've got, see, all of these people that do Ecclesiastes 12 claim, some of them say, well, it's too hard. We can't know what he's talking about here. Well, if you understand it's allegory, and they do, then you can sit down and take it in its context and eventually work out from the information you have what's going on here. And I've just about decided that in verse 6, what we've got is an allegory, obviously, but we are going to go back to verse 2. We're down at the end of the death-shadowed valley. And what it's going to remind us of down at the end of verse 6, where it says that, you know, the mourners are out in the street. Well, okay, we go back up to verse 2, and verse 2 is an allegory, in my view, describing Ecclesiastes 4, verses 17 through 19. Ecclesiastes 4, 17 through 19 has to do with the mataotes vacuum creating darkness in the soul. Well, you can go to Ecclesiastes 12, 2 and see a perfect allegory for that. Now when you get down to the end of verse 6, you're going to see a reference back up to verse 2. And it's the verse 2 sets the stage. The whole problem is the man's made it to old age and he has no spiritual life. Now he's at the end of the death-shadowed valley, and it really comes home there because he's about to die the sin unto death as a result of it all. Well, I don't know why I'm telling you these things. I haven't got it all worked out yet. But that's the gist of it, and we'll have it worked out by Tuesday, because when I get through today, we'll be there. So I need to have that worked out by Tuesday. Well, let's get to the grasshopper guy. He's dragging himself along. First of all, the allegory comes from observing the structure of the grasshopper's legs, which are connected much like a human's. So I had to look at that, and if you go through your research, you realize that the one that's being referenced is this one up here, this front leg. Now, if you will look at that as a man sitting in a chair, you can get the image here. This is the foot here, and this is the lower leg, this is the knee, this right here is the thigh, and right here is the hip joint, the coxa, C-O-X-A. There's the hip joint. And you have a person in a seated position if you can see that well enough. So the grasshopper's leg. Front leg is constructed much like a human's leg. Two, what we would call the foot is the grasshopper's tarsus. That's labeled tarsus here. That's the foot down here at the bottom. His lower leg is the tibia, T-I-B-I-A, and maybe you can see it labeled here, the lower leg, and then there's the knee joint right there. The upper leg or thigh is called the femur, F-E-M-U-R, and that is right here. Point three, that which makes it all work is the coxa, which for a human is called the hip joint, and that you can see right here. That's the hip joint, and he's seated. He's in a chair, so to speak. Four, when the old man's hips go out on him, he literally has to drag himself along, much as a grasshopper would have to do if his coxa blew out on him. Note how he'd just fall on his face. The grasshopper would. He would just keel over, and he would have to drag himself along with these other units back here. Now, how about the man whose hips blow out on him? Have you ever known anyone whose hips are gone? They have to literally stagger along. I know a man down in Alabama who's had both hips replaced, and he still staggers along. Some of you know him. He's the guy that owns all the trucks that run up and down the road, Wiley Sanders. And while his hips are gone, both of them have been replaced, and I understand he staggers along. And this is how he describes that. The grasshopper drags himself along. Now, here's one. This is a way to cap off our Sunday study. Ecclesiastes 12:5d. And the caperberry is ineffective. The caperberry is ineffective. Point one. The caperberry is the berry-like flower buds of the caper bush. Bet you would guess that. The berry-like flower buds of the caper bush. It was used in the ancient world as an herb that would stimulate the appetite. Now, I gather that there are some herbs you can use today to stimulate the appetite. You ladies build these little hors d'oeuvres. In the South, that's hors d'oeuvres. You build hors d'oeuvres and you put them out for your guests when they come in, and they usually have a lot of spices in them, and it's supposed to stimulate the appetite for the big meal you've prepared. So too, it was also believed by many people in that day. Some of you take copious notes, and I know you'll be headed to the herb store once you hear this. It was also believed by many in that day to be an aphrodisiac, stimulating another kind of appetite. Three, when legalists encounter this word in Ecclesiastes, they interpret it to mean that Solomon's appetite was gone and his taste buds were shot. And even the caperberry used as spices couldn't stimulate his appetite. Four, the grace-oriented expositors are not afraid to go with the loss of sexual desires. Five. So, whether the caperberry in this passage refers to an early day equivalent of an hors d'oeuvre or to Viagra, loss of desire in either area is associated with aging. Six. since Solomon couldn't eat the best foods prepared by the best chefs, leads us to believe the former. Remember, we had him around a banquet table earlier. All of the best foods prepared by the best chefs are in and there in his banquet hall. All these people are lined up eating this magnificent cuisine, and he's there with oatmeal and Pepto-Bismol. So it's a good shot that the capybara here could be the stimulant for appetite, for food appetite. We also could note another thing that we've picked up from our study. The demands of attempting to accommodate a harem of over 1,000 women causes us to believe the capybara may have been an aphrodisiac at least some point in his life. So knowing that Solomon was a major league reversionist, I conclude it was both. Ecclesiastes 12:5e. For man goes to his eternal home while mourners go about in the street. Now the poor bloke is about to die. And we have 4 points here plus our corrected translation, but this really is the point where Solomon dies. And then we go into Ecclesiastes 12 verse 6, where we do see his final moments and his actual death, and then verse 7, the conclusion to it all. So I think this is a good spot to stop, and we will see his death throes and his eventual death occur on Tuesday evening. Heavenly Father, we are grateful to you for this concept that we are noting, the concept that in old age there are certain things that confront us, and Bible doctrine is the thing that gives us tranquility of soul in order to endure these things. May we be wise enough in a period of physical prosperity to take advantage of the advantage. The advantage is the ability to show up and learn Bible doctrine, so that this inventory of ideas will sustain us in an environment of tranquility during our sunset years. Motivate and encourage us by these things as we lift our prayer in Christ's name. Charis human kai rene, plethun thae in epinosai tu theu kai iesu tu kuriu hemon. And now may grace and prosperity be multiplied unto you by means of your knowledge of God and of Jesus our Lord. Amen. Guide me, O thy great Jehovah, shall we stand as we sing.